Welcome to Out of Character. I've got Cotton, who's already started to annoy me. Hello, Cotton.
Hello, how's it going?
Now he's not quick to talk any other time.
Right, I had been chastised. Some might say duly.
And we've also got Oz joining us.
Hello and good evening.
And we are going to talk about world building. And I know we've discussed this before, but it was probably a couple, probably 3 years ago. And I just wanted to see, you know, since Cotton's been GMing now, and I, you know, he's been doing the module, but I kind of want to see his approach to world building. And as you've been a GM for a while, and I want to hear about your approach to world building. So who wants to go first?
That would be Cotton. Cotton wants to go first.
Wonderful, wonderful. So world building has not been a great strength of mine in this particular round because it was a one shot. Like, I had the basis of a plot, and they all come to town in this caravan. And as I'm telling them, you have a riven in the town of, and I didn't name the town. And so I just named it a riven. I was like, that's a good name. You've now come to the town of a riven. So that was not a great example of world building. I do have world building in the past for a campaign I intended to run. But I do think that did set sort of a goofy tone, right? Hey, this is a goofy one shot. We're not going to take ourselves too seriously. Our GM is kind of fast and loose with his world building. So after that, though, I did do the patented steal everything that's not bolted down from other forms of media that hopefully your players haven't seen.
All right, so you're not really, like, coming up with stuff or pulling up name generators or anything like that. You're just quickly coming up with something, usually punny. And you're not really prepping, right? You don't seem to really prep. You're just taking from other sources, right?
This one, yeah, I do a little bit of prep on a dungeon. Like, I'll come up with what I think are some cool encounters, and I'll sketch out sort of, like, the shape of a dungeon that would fit around those encounters. And then for the people and individuals, I will come up with, like, I'll hit a fantasy name generator until it has, like, a vaguely fantasy name for something. You know? And then I'm like, oh, that's about right. Two syllables, not too hard to pronounce. There we go. That's the new name for you. And I will sort of, like, take the appearance of, like, something from a movie or a video game or whatever the hell as sort of, like, what they look like. Right? And then what they act like might be a different character. It'll be a little hodgepodge. So, I mean, I can go into, like, a character, like, there's an NPC that I designed, and I can, like, go over them and do that, or we can go around the table, or I'm not sure. You're the host of the thing. What do you want to do there?
No, I just want to hear about how you approach world building, and you've explained that.
There we go. Steal, mix and mash, and think what you, you know, find something cool. Oh, I do want to add one more thing. Think of something that is cliche, and then change the cliche. Because it's so easy to get into a cliched character, right? This is the straight from central casting, grizzled veteran. This is the nerdy science guy. Here's the amoral businessman. Like, there's just sort of these stock central characters. The best way to, like, avoid the niche for me is to not avoid the niche, just, like, take it and then plug it in there and then change it. I have an easier time with that. Like, I identify the things that are cliche. This character fits my needs, and then I dress them up a little bit. You know, I change, I give them a little bit something different in their appearance, and then I will also give them something to care about that is sort of runs counter to what the stereotype may be. So they may be an amoral businessman, but they may have a daughter with a handicap who they absolutely care about 100,000%. You know, like that, they would sell you out, but they would burn the earth alive for that daughter. That kind of a thing, you know, okay. to complicate out from the cliche.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Oz, how do you approach world building?
So I approach it with first, like, I plan the general story arc of the game. So in this case, you know, I've got one thing I'm doing right now, obviously, which is Alien. The premise of Alien is the slow but inexorable fall of a colony. And so I started, planning. It's like, okay, this is where we're going to start. These are the little areas that we'll go to. And I kind of build organically from there. Like the very first thing was, here's a throwaway research station with a weird geological phenomenon. And this is where it's going to start. And so in the alien system, which ironically, Weyland-Yutani's slogan is building better worlds. So, haha, there it is. He said the thing. But there is a system for actually building a planet. And so that's what I started with. I'm like, okay, here's where in the galaxy it's located. I said it's a single sun. There's a couple of other planets. They've got, Weyland-Yutani's got a spaceship headquarters that's a couple of light minutes out. And one of the things that it says is, what is the planet-wide quirk that it has? And I chose, at night, the planet is wreathed in thick fog, because that's amazing. It's great. It's exactly what I want. And I didn't do a lot of planning for the first mission, because I'm going to wipe this place from the map. That was the secret goal of one of the characters, was just to wipe this colony out. And then I went to the next one, which was an actual town, and then a marshal station. And the marshal station was easy. Like, this is a throwaway home base that these people probably won't ever see again. And then I built the town. And in the alien system, all that stuff is really easy, because they've got a corporate approved plan for building. And so when I plan the scenario is when I make the area. And then I just make sure to write it down so I can remember it later. But with the second thing I'm doing, it's the same thing. It's like, I've got a premise. And, the premise is, it's D&D 5th edition, so you all start in a bar, haha. But now I've got to build this bar, and I'm like, what makes this bar interesting? And so the thing behind that is, the owner of the bar has made every conceivable bad decision regarding this business that could ever be made. Short of just, he doesn't even burn it down for the insurance money, okay? That's how bad this is. And so I start building that thing, and then I start going out. Like, I'll have name generators and stuff, I think a little bit about the owner of this bar, and it's like, how did he get to this point? It's like, if he's making all these bad decisions, he's an idiot, or he's cursed, or both. And so then I think about, well, if he's an idiot, then how did he still open this bar? Oh, he was probably an ex-adventurer, because that's the dream of all adventurers, is to settle down, and once you're done fucking up the economies of every town, city, and kingdom around you, you settle down and wait for that money to flow back into your pockets. And now that I've got that little world there, like, all right, what's my hook? And so the hook is, the owner disappears. And now you've got this party of individuals who meet in a bar, except this time, they're not adventurers, they're the staff. And that's where we're going to get started. And so now I've got that first adventure in mind, and that'll finish building the bar. And then as we move into the second mission, then things kind of flow out from there, with this first location kind of being the epicenter of the campaign. And then I can kind of develop everything out as it kind of flows out. It's like pouring like chocolate syrup on top of ice cream, right? It just hits that first point and it just flows down from there.
Okay. Fuzz, who is listening along with Psychotron and Leo, Fuzz had some comments about world building, and I had said he could come on and talk to us about how he approaches world building as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way of going about it, that Oz does. I kind of use a similar system, but I would say a lot of what I put into it when I'm starting to set think up a setting is sort of what are the types of stories you want to tell. And I, for me, you know, anyone who's ever played with me, I tend to lean towards psychological drama amongst the characters. And so I want something that's going to be a hook that'll somehow, you know, there needs to be some form of conflict that will always be in the background that can sort of be divisive in some way. You know, there's some sort of political issue, or there's some sort of humanitarian issue, or there's some sort of something that always adds that layer of tension that's always just beneath the surface, such that you can always, you know, anytime you're running out of interesting things in terms of your own story, you can just dip into that and tie it back into, you know, the war going on in the background. Or if it's D&D, you know, like, oh, you're in a nation, you're at that bar, you know, like Oz was saying, and, you know, but this nation happens to be at war with this other seafaring nation that's far away. The war isn't actually affecting the city until all of a sudden it does, because that just serves your purposes and it helps to propel your plot along, you know. And I feel like that's something a lot of people miss, because you can get really stagnant locations when you're making a world where, you know, it's, you're in this peaceful king, like for example, Cormyr, for Forgotten Realms. It's boring and shitty because it's just medieval fantasy land sitting on a hill and there's nothing going on. And there's no, usually not any wars. Nothing's really happening. The Purple Knights run around and like enforce whatever. And it's like, okay, we just made like the most boring setting because there's no tension. And there's not, like, what am I supposed to do with this now? You know, and you have to make your own story. Whereas if you make the setting itself have this baseline, at any moment, crazy shit could happen, that helps you, right? And you don't have to use it, but it's right there, right? And it's always there that you can always just tap right into it. You know, in Vampire, there's always that threat of, well, you could be walking along and the Sabbat could come and screw up everything. You know, because now they're basically a terrorist organization in V5. The Second Inquisition could show up because you pissed them off or you messed with the masquerade too much. You know, there's all these different outside forces that are just hovering right in the periphery that at any time you can just inject into the story to spice things up whenever you need them to. And I think that's a key thing to a setting.
So, you talked about psychological. Are you going for a psychological thriller? Are there like some movies or books or stories that you can sort of reference and say, this is what I'm trying to get? This is a moment I'm trying to kind of replicate or resurrect or invoke into my game.
The best example I could think of, honestly, which is not even psychological thriller, it's more horrible, at least when it comes to, like, say, World of Darkness, if I'm running a vampire game. I'm having a complete mental block right now because it's been a long day. The movie where the woman has to choose between her two daughters. You know, she has the one kid to basically save the life of the other kid.
Sophie's Choice?
Yes, Sophie's Choice. Like, that's the type of psychological thriller drama I'm talking about. Where it's like, you got a rock and a hard place, and the rock is covered in diarrhea. You know, like pick one. It's not always a terrible decision, but it's you know, it's very much like I guess The Witcher would be a good example, where, you know, there's a silver lining to everything, but there's also something bad happens, you know, or you have to make some sort of sacrifice. And seeing what people choose is what's interesting to me as the person running the story, because, you know, I'm curious about what your character will choose, but I'm also curious about what you'll choose. And then the question is, you know, are you comfortable with what makes sense for your character? And if not, let's talk about it, you know, because that's an interesting dichotomy sometimes where, you know, well, my character would really do this, but I don't feel comfortable doing that. And it's like, okay, that's fine. We don't have to do that, but let's discuss that a little bit more, you know, because then we learn something.
Right. I do think it's interesting to bring up like genres. Like I like the psych thriller. I like those tough choices. I also really like noir. It's one of the things that think is often done in cyberpunk kind of worlds. It's one of the things that you can see in certain Shadowrun, like stories or games that I've been in. And I tried to, my first ever run was a very noirish kind of like detective story. It was like find out what the fuck happened and why with an overly convoluted plot. So that was mine. I gravitate toward that. I want to make Chinatown into a game. I don't know how. I've seen Chinatown twice. Still don't fully understand the plot. but I want to make it into a game. But what about y'all? Are there certain genres that you're like, I want to make this into a game? You know, or that you gravitate towards? I guess, like, you know, thematically like that.
I mean, I already did a lot of talking just now, but going on like, here, like noir, Oz or cyberpunk or, noir, yeah. Blade Runner is a great example of cyberpunk noir that I've always wanted to like run a good Blade Runner game. You know,
I think for me, I don't really pull from a lot of like media. The D&D campaign is less about like a movie I'm pulling from and more of like past experiences. Like this is literally like the experience of the everyman having to deal with bureaucracy and competition and how capitalism is the bad guy. And then I mean Alien is literally just I put a ticking grenade in the center of the table and then I let the players do their thing. And that's just how that goes, and it's great. And yeah, there's an overarching story that's going on, but it's really, you know, are these people going to be able to get through? And there's really not a, like, if I was going to play it to an Alien movie, like, I should have killed more of these fuckers a long time ago, but I haven't.
Okay. So what I find interesting right now is when we started recording, I said we're going to talk about world building. And I've listened to all three of you, and you all seem to center on story first, and then you build out from that.
Sounds fair so far.
Yep.
Sounds fair, right? Okay.
We're wrong. Are we wrong?
story is 100% the number one.
Okay. Yeah. So when I think world building, and I've, you know, in a homebrew game, like Aliens, that we know that setting. I mean, we just have to slap on some names of some planets and moons and whatever. D&D, we know it's a fantasy setting. We got that. But if you were to do a homebrew game and you were to create your own map and your own cities and its own economy and history and lore and all of it, rumors, political landscape, like, have you ever like built the world?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, for my
I've
first
done that
ever
a couple
campaign.
Times.
Okay, all right.
It was hard.
So it is
I did it. I did it for the equivalent of making an MMORPG, since it was a persistent world and never went to nights where we had like 120 something players. Yeah. Okay. So we had to make the entire setting from scratch.
So I've done that, the, you know, drawing a map, coming up with the name, all of that stuff. And I find that it is hard, Cotton. It's very hard. It's a lot of work to do, to think about it, to come up with names, the maps, and all of this stuff. And I found that as I ran it, it was a lot of work, and it didn't seem to have any kind of a payoff. Like, your players were just like, okay, like, they didn't really, and it kind of, I don't know, I didn't get my return on the investment, you know?
Did they do the thing you wanted them to do?
They did the thing. It was just, it was like, all that work wasn't really acknowledged. So then I was like, all right. So then I think, well, maybe it's because I did it myself. And then another time I did world building, I did some of the maps. I did the maps, but I let the players come up with locations, you know, cities, locations, what's the rumor going on there? What is it like? What's the main crop? All that stuff. And I like that better because it makes the whole table have to join in to create the world that you're all going to be in. Do you guys, like, how do you guys approach it? Do you let your world unfold to your players, or do you have your players help you build it?
I have never had my players help me build it, but this past summer when I was doing the classes with my wife Robin at her summer camp, there was a D&D module, and you can download it off their website, although it's kind of hard to find now. But it's a module where the people work to, where all the people participating work on world building with specific like assignments. It's like everyone here has to come up with like a place or a geographic feature. And then, like, what's there? Here's some examples of what was there. Like, it can be a place of safety. It can be a place where an enemy is. Is it a cave? Come up with, like, a geographic feature, like a lake or a mountain. And so everyone is sitting here around the table contributing to one large poster board with their crayons and markers, drawing out this world together. And it sounds like you, and then, like, you're supposed to play in that world as a follow-up. It sounds like, is that what you did? Did, like, one of your players invent the tavern and a different player invent, you know, like the keep that they would all go to, or NPCs?
No, they would. So in the zero session, it would be, all right, here's our map. What city is your person from and where is it? And they just pop it on the map. All right, describe it to me. What does it look like? What's the terrain? Is it coastal? Is it mountain? What is it? And I just ask them questions to kind of get an idea of what the city is that their character is from. And then, you know, I take notes, and we know all know now that that city does this stuff. Okay.
Cool. I'll admit I didn't do that.
No? Okay.
I had my players show up on the island, and I like islands because they're self-contained, right? And it was a large, convoluted, noirish plot, and it did pay off. It was a ton of work, but like there was a great point where they cracked my game, basically. Like they found out the information of the core of the plot, right? They figured out the big turn way earlier than I had anticipated through some very slick play. And they were one up on everybody, right? Like imagine if halfway through the Humphrey Bogart movie, Sam Spade figures the shit out, right? And then the payoff was they go back to town and they were so fucking nervous they blew it. Like they just choked. they were like they saw danger behind every corner. Like they knew who all the bad guys were. The bad guys did not know at all that anyone was even on their tail. And they knew it. They just fucked it right up. It was great.
I've done both. So it depends on context, I feel like. So in your situation, you know, where it's like, well, you have this small table with one little group. Yeah, I would agree that like making an entire new like D&D setting, for example, like here's this whole nation, here's the whole world, here's this whole planet, like that's a lot. And your chances of having your five or six players, you know, really get into the setting itself, I mean, could go well, but it's a lot of work for very little payout in that situation. Versus, say, you're making like a MUD or something like in Neverwinter Nights Persistent World, where it's like, I'm going to have 20, 30, 40 people at least playing this, probably maybe even hundreds, you know? And so then a whole bunch of them are probably going to get really into the setting and really enjoy it and really take a benefit of this. And from there, I'll get some love back. But going back to your idea of having the players do a lot of the work for you, I do that all the time, particularly in stuff like World of Darkness, which is, you know, it's kind of an easy layup to do for that, because a lot of the times you're just setting it in like a real city. You can be like, okay, we're playing in Seattle. All right, here's the map of Seattle. And it's just like, tell me your character's backgrounds. Like, who are the people your characters know? And I use that to help sort of inform my own plans, because I have rough ideas of like, okay, well, the council for the Camarilla is going to look like this. You know, there's going to be one guy who's like a sneaky asshole. I don't know what his clan is. I don't really care. Like, I'll plan that out once the players tell me, you know, and they'll be like, one of them will say, oh yeah, my sire is this, you know, really upstanding guy, but his sire is really powerful and in the city and is a sneaky asshole. I'm like, great. Guess who that primogen is now? Like, that's your grandsire, you know? And that's how I build out the entire thing. And so then when they jump into the world, all of a sudden they have all these direct connections to everything and to each other, and things overlap heavily. And where I love to do stuff where like somebody's touchstone is involved with somebody's enemy, you know, somebody else's enemy. So now there's conflicting interests between the party, where it's like, I want to kill this dude, but if I do, it could hurt this other person's touchstone, so that person may foil me from fighting my own enemy because, you know, that's just the way it is. They got to protect their person, you know, and that's tension. And that's the drama, right? And then the question of, you know, the psychological thriller aspect, I guess, or the social aspect of it, rather, less than psych, is, you know, what are people going to, when all the cards are on the table and you have to choose between your own person and helping out your party member, like, what are they going to choose? And is there going to be fallout now? Are you guys going to have a beef? Like, do we have to play that out? You know, and so that's, you know, part of the whole thing. And so it really depends on the type of game and the setting that you're doing, on which one that I'll choose in terms of how deep I'll go.
Okay. Us?
I have not really had any players help me out, I guess. And I'm going to start doing that with the D&D campaign. But like for Alien, it's been all me. For Shadowrun, it's, even though Shadowrun has the tools in place to have your players have buy-in, generally it's been, okay, it's me. And a lot of that is also because, like, scheduling and stuff, I'm like, all right, well, tell me about your contacts, and then I get a lot of, and so everybody's kind of at odds with one another, so there's really nothing I can work with there. But for, like, the D&D game, it's going to be, okay, I'm making this bar because I've already got that thing fully fleshed out in my head. But, you know, tell me about the neighborhoods you guys hail from. Tell me about, you know, the domiciles that you live in, if you live in any. You know, do you sleep in the stables out back, or do you have a little shotgun house or a crossbow house that you can open the front and back door and fire a crossbow through and don't hit anything that's, you know, in this row of houses? Or, you know, have people tell me about that, and then I can start sketching out kind of like sectors of the city. It's like, all right, well, now that I know where these sectors are, I can make a plan regarding those. And then as those get resolved, then I'll keep on asking for more information. Like, all right, what rumors do you think you've heard about this thing?
I've noticed that your style, by the way, Oz, is very... You like to lead the players through something, kind of like a docent at a museum. Uh-huh. Like, you take a lot of special care in, like, describing every ounce of the furniture and the paintings on the wall and a physical feature on an NPC. I think it's kind of like that's your... showing off. That's like, you, I don't know if you want us in your playhouse. Like, it's showing, like, look at this world I've created for you. Are you not entertained? I gotta give a little bit of a, that's your flourish. That's fine.
There's a little bit of that, and a lot of that is because my description style is hit all five senses. If I can hit all five senses, then everybody absolutely knows what they want to focus on. So, like, if you walk into a basement and, you know, I'm describing, it's like, it's dark, but you can see, like, it's when the light comes in through the cracks of the floorboards, you can tell it's kind of, it's got dust in the air. You know, it smells like mold and rot. And, you know, you brush your fingers against the stone of the wall of the basement, it comes away damp. Like, you get those. It's like, okay, very, very clearly there's a water source nearby, and it's there's water damage down here. And then I can let the players logic themselves out.
Should I be worried that if I ever have you come to my house, you're going to start licking things?
Probably not. No promises.
Have you guys ever, like, decided on something, decided on a city name, a location, NPC name, whatever? Have you ever decided, made the decision, but then when the players hit that point in your game, they made assumptions that were better than the ideas you've had, and you just kind of like rework it immediately based off of what they just said?
Yep.
Have you altered your world based on player action during the game?
I'll never admit it.
Yeah. I never, exactly. You never actually admit to
it's,
it.
It's like totally a,
do. But you do it.
Yeah.
Everybody's done it, but nobody wants to. You're fine stealing from everything else, RC.
They think that you're an amazing GM if you peel. They're like, wow, you made that seamless. And it's like, yeah, I totally did, even though I was copying your homework, basically.
It's seamless because I just made it, and I've never stopped. At no point have I stopped lying. So there's nothing, there's no seams, right? It's an unfurling, endless tapestry of horseshit. And so it's like video cards in a computer only render exactly what you can see, right? It's like you think you're in a world. You're not. You are whatever your monitor, everything else is just black, is not existing right now. That is my GM style. Whatever you can, whatever I have not committed to is subject to change. And I... Mm-hmm. At no point do I ever feel beholden to anything. I think one of the first things GMs need to do outside of anything is stop pretending like there's any chains on you. You can do whatever the fuck you want. It's great.
As long as you follow the rules.
All right.
They apply to you too.
Do they? We'll agree and disagree. That's a different debate. Tune in to the next show where
I will say that, stemming off of what Cotton's saying, I've seen a lot of GMs where I've been the player, and where they fail is where they don't want to like give up. They keep clinging on to this whatever plan that they had, you know, like they introduce this NPC and they're like, this guy's gonna be badass, and the players are gonna think this guy is awesome, and like get really into this NPC, and this NPC is going to send them on this great quest. And then, you know, and he'll be the Strider, you know, sitting in the corner of the Tattern, the mysterious stranger. And then the players come in and they don't give a shit about that dude at all. And they're like too busy looking at the stupid gnome who's like chilling in the corner, like playing with a cat, you know, and they'll keep trying to redirect the person back to like the badass Strider guy. And it's just like, your players have spoken. They aren't interested in that. They want to hang out with this gnome because they want to see what this cat's going to do next. Clearly I want to know what the cat's going to go do next too. So you got to be humble. As I think that's one of the biggest things as a GM is like, when you make a world or you make a setting or you make any sort of story, you got to be willing to just be like, my players aren't into it. Throw it out. Let's go a different direction. And I feel like that is one of the biggest barriers to people to getting their GMing to the next level, or just retaining players, or just having a campaign where people are like, man, this was great, because they're too wrapped up in their own stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a GM that tries to keep everyone on a very short leash to follow their very specific course, That's not how you GM. That's not a good way. It has to be, I like the more, you know, sandbox style of, you know, you're here. Talk to people and let's see what happens, you know. You know, if you want me to put a giant board with jobs, I will, but I mean, is that what you want? Okay.
I like the job board. You don't like the job board? Yeah, like my next campaign will absolutely have a job board because it adds to the sandbox. It's like, I don't care. It's my way. It's almost a show off. It's saying, I don't need you to go from A to B to C to D. Mm-hmm. I have a whole list of things. You can go wherever you want. The entire map is built. Everything is constructed. All this planned in my gigantic, you know, GM brain, right? And it's sort of a flex, in my opinion, and lets them spice things up. And it kind of is at least to me, a shorthand for side quest, right? Obviously, there's reasons you may not want to point or may not want to put a major like plot point, to the extent you have one, on a job board, lest they not do it. So it's kind of become shorthand in games and in like video games, and I think in D&D games, for there to be a job board that's kind of like, you know, here there be side quest to to punctuate the linear nature. Maybe that plot's getting a bit heavy, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's a great thing for world building, frankly, is to have a quest board, right? Of like, really? Go out and do some shit.
But so how much of that quest board do you actually have pre-built out? Like if you say, show them the quest board and there's like 10 jobs on there, like did you actually plan out basics, at least, of 10 different jobs?
Yeah, but I wouldn't put 10. I'd put like 4 or 5. And then I would have those 4 or 5 like cocked and ready to go. Right. Mm-hmm. And then if they burn through them, then guess what? The old quest board is going to be empty for a little while we replenish our reserves. And over time, we might cycle some of those out. Or if they ignore a quest, that quest might become sort of upgraded. Right. Like mm-hmm. this was a level 1 quest. They didn't give a shit about it. Now that problem has grown. Right. So now I'm actually you thought it was a minor detail. Well, so it turns out that little goblin cave you didn't go that like stole. Big Bob's pumpkin from Big Bob's pumpkin farm. Now that's a whole goblin outpost, and they're actually threatening the realm in a serious way. In the army, it can't quite deal with it. So that's boom. You've kind of world built it out there. It was a minor detail. It was a minor side quest. Surprise! It was a real fucking thing. You know, like shit's popping off, and now I can actually change my direction if the players aren't feeling whatever I was putting down at first. So I like that it kind of opened my first campaign was very. Well, it's like kind of sandboxy in terms of it looked sandboxy from a glance, but the campaign was quite linear. It was go from A, and then A has clues to B, and B has clues to C, and oh, holy shit, you guys, D and E are on the map at the same time. You can do D and then E, or you can do E and D, whatever fucking quarter you want, or what is it, sequence you want. And then there's that F. F's coming. Like, that's kind of what my campaign was, because it was safe. If I had a job board, I could have punctuated that up. I could have traveled them around to different areas. And I had basics of lore of those areas. I could have explored that a little bit better. It could have come in from a different direction. And I think it would have really taken that to the next level.
All right. Oz, what do you think of the job board idea in your world building? Yeah.
I've never had an opportunity to use a job board in... Mm-hmm. anything that I've done. If my players want one, they've never said it. On the other hand, you know, you've got Shadowrun, which is job board, the RPG.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, the job board, every job on it is you're going to do this thing that I already planned. So mm-hmm. sit down and buckle in. But I'm amenable to having a job board. If that's what you want to do, yeah, I can make an adventurer's guild, or you players can make an adventurer's guild. You know, my players are smart and wonderful and talented people. I am certain that they are going to come up with wild ways to try and break the world.
Mm-hmm.
And a job board is a great way of starting that, to be honest.
Definitely used it on occasion. It depends on what game you're running very much, but yeah, I mean, and you can also just present what is essentially a job board in a different way, you know, like, you know, you're playing Star Wars and you went into a cantina and, you know, there's a handful of different key NPCs that you sort of describe like Oz does, you know, describing the setting, and depending on who interests them, that's going to be a different job that they're going to go for. Right. But I would say, I'm kind of a weirdo, unlike Cotton, in that I generally don't, like, I have a basic framework in my head for what most jobs will be. Like, oh, this will be, go to this place, try and do this. I won't really name, like, spell out NPCs or anything. I just make up everything on the fly as we go. Like, that's, I'm terrible like that, but I do it all the time.
Yeah.
But that's the fun for me is can I stay 2 steps ahead of them at all mm-hmm. times, and make it seem seamless and not like I'm ever struggling? Cause that's the fun part for me is sort of, you know, being the midnighter, to use a comic book reference, to, my party of people.
I want all of you to think back over your entire gaming career and as a player in a tabletop RPG. Can you guys remember, or, you know, anything that like a GM threw at you that like impressed you, like, wow, that's really good, I'm definitely gonna steal that, in their world building that you've like, yeah, that was great what they did, I loved it, or I'm gonna steal that, or anything from anybody on that?
God, I have a terrible memory. I know the emotion. I have felt it in a lot of games. Oh, okay. I've got one in your game that you had This is very helpful for our listeners because it was the one that was never publicized. Great. As an example, no one will know. We were in a D&D game. Jupiter was the GM. And there was a... And Bamps had a character that was like a frog kin. They're not frog kin, but they're fucking frog kin. Okay.
He was a and grog.
There you go. And...
Grung.
Grung. There we go. And they have like poisonous or venomous, sorry, skin, whatever the fuck it is. And... I'm like, okay, he's a little frog dude, and he goes around and tries to hug people, but then they get poisoned, and it's sad. It's kind of, but in a funny way. It was this most, like, womp-womp character. And then, like, the dude, like, the grung finds his grung people, and he rejoins his old grung society, and he is, at that moment, realized how important to him the connections he made with this party of adventurers is, as he has to let go and rejoin his people and like lead them forward in the future. It was fucking sad. You know, and you like made that shit up a lot of it, or it felt like you did. You know, you and Bamp kind of working. I don't necessarily know if y'all were in concert, but like you designing like the people and that the, I think you had his people were like enslaved on some like ship in a port. And we just happened to investigate it, I think, on some jangly key bullshit. Yeah, that's pretty impressive. That, like, out of nowhere, on a thing I thought was a lark for a goofball character, you, like, brought in his backstory. You brought in his people being in, like, the dungeon of a ship. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Okay.
Am I remembering it incorrectly?
Mm-hmm. No. No, he found other grung. They were on a slaver ship. And he freed his people, and then he realized he needed to get them to their own, like, a place that they can live.
Yeah, especially because when they were hanging with us, we did try to sell them as...
I did not remember that part.
Yeah. I'm going to make a reference that probably only Oz will get, and it will make him so mad. But you pulled a Neelix then.
Babylon 5 reference?
No, on Star Trek Voyager, Neelix, who is one of the more hated characters, although I actually like Neelix.
I like Neelix.
But he finds his own people and like a like little outpost of them hiding out, and then he realizes, well, shit, I need to make sure that they survive. And he leaves the crew, and that's the last you ever see of Neelix, like halfway through the last season. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we did that because in my world, I was trying to, on this port, trying to indicate that they do some, you know, under the table deals. So I had the slaver ship there, letting you know I got some pretty despicable people in here and they do crime. But when Bamps' character went and, you know, saw that they were other grung and then saw that they were on a slave trade ship and that they were being held and all that, he decided I have to save my people. Well, that took us down that road of Bamps eventually hitting a point where he realized his character would stay with his people. So, yeah, we had to say goodbye. It was sad, though.
It was really sad. He was not expecting to do it, I think, up until the point where he did it.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I recall him saying.
Yeah. He didn't know if he would do it, and then he did it. In the middle of the game, he decided, and he did it, and it was sad. Same question, Oz.
There are little things that I've kind of absorbed through osmosis, through a lot of the games that I've played. I know it isn't the question, but there's a lot of things I know I won't do because a GM did it. I'm like, I'm absolutely leaving that. That can stay in there. Which is why the biggest reason that I don't base anything really off of any media or like any ideas is because of the Unseelie Food Court. That was a Game of Thrones based, like the dude was really into it and he was really into the Lannisters. And you could tell the game was so terrible. I'm like, there's absolutely nothing I want to take from that. As for things that I have taken, it was another one of your games, Jeeps, the other D&D game when I was playing Ichneel to No Man, where you would ask me like little things about my character, and that's it made me a better player, because you know he's sitting there, he's a barbarian that was based off of a silly comic where his goal was to eat the meat of every beast, and he turned into a bardbarian where he was a campfire tender who turned into a storyteller and believed in one too many of his stories, and then took the ancestral axe of the tribe and ran off to go do adventure. But then thinking of those stories, you ask me about the stories, and I start telling this stupid story about Sicknail the Fat, who, when the tribe was stuck in a blizzard in where they now call home, he skated down the mountain along the ice floes and slew two mammoths and ate the first one on the spot, and then dragged the second back to the tribe, where they all ate so much that they hibernated until the blizzard had passed. It was so dumb, but it was so much fun to write. And it I think built a little part of your world. I was building out this little nomad tribe that consisted almost entirely of freed and liberated slaves that had a very significant oral tradition.
Yeah, no, it did, because now we knew that there was this little group and this is what they did. So if anybody ever ran into them again, they would know. Fuzz?
Well, similarly, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I've definitely in the same vein as Oz, like seen, and I'm like, okay, I'm never doing that for various reasons. But one thing that I can't remember exactly who was the first game. This was like over 20 years ago, and I want to say it was Shadowrun. I'm almost positive it was Shadowrun. In fact, that we were playing. It was like third edition. And he did this great thing where, you know, when we first started the campaign, there's always that awkward phase of like, well, why are you all together? You know, and unless you happen to write overlapping backstories, like it's usually kind of lame, or it's like, oh yeah, you're Johnson, you know, Mr. Johnson put you together. You know, he just threw you all together because this was convenient. And it's like, okay, well, fine. You know, that works for now, but it doesn't really give me anything, right? It could also just be, you know, oh, you happen to be in a bar and you're all hanging out in this, you know, very obviously, you know, Shadowrunny bar that's totally sketchy, and Lone Star just raided the place and you're all on the run and you all happen to band together. That may not go as well as planned, but it's one way to kind of have a shared backstory of like, wow, glad we got out of that. What this guy did was something so much more clever. He actually did like a total script flip, like essentially, where he had us all just sort of make random people. And we weren't actually, he said specifically, he's like, don't make Shadowrunners. Like, I'm going to tell you a game, you're not going to be Shadowrunners, but we're going to use the Shadowrun setting. So goblinization, all that stuff, but it's still Seattle. And we're like, all right, fine. So we made all these different types of, you know, like my guy was he worked for Seder Krupp. He was like an arms dealer. And then, you know, everyone had like a different thing. Not everybody was a corpo. My guy was one of the two people that was a corpo. And then he decided, okay, well, based off of what we made, he started the game as like a prologue to the actual campaign. And he set it in this, like the Seattle conference hall as like this big industrial conference. And like one of the players was like working a food court stand, and one of us, like my guy, was actually there like to see some weapons, you know, demonstration to possibly, you know, acquire this small company for Seder Krupp. And then one of the guys was like actually had a presentation, you know, because his corporation was present. I think he was Aztec. Yeah, he was an Aztec mage, which was fun. It was interesting, to say the least. But and we're all just sort of in this position. And this was the prologue. He said, like, this is just the prologue. This isn't the actual campaign yet. And we're like, okay, fine. And then he used that prologue to write in plain sight, show us who the big bad was. Although at that time, we didn't even know it was the big bad. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, just this random corporate guy who just happened to be in the audience, you know. And then he sort of threw it all on its head because the entire place gets bombed. And we all had to do that whole, you know, oh, you all have to escape and band together. And then we all basically get burned by our various situations. And we all ended up, so in the long run, yes, we ended up being Shadowrunners. know, by way of this crazy event that turned everything on its head. And I was like, this is a really cool way of doing it, because like I did the same thing for a zombie apocalypse type game where I had them all sort of start out playing in this sort of X-Files-y sort of setting of Hunter. And then it was a Hunter game, like Hunter the Vigil. And I didn't tell them like, oh, this is actually going to be a zombie survival game, but it rapidly turned into that and they had no idea. And then they loved it. They were like, that was the greatest twist right up front. Like, we were not expecting this and now we're thrown into it. And so you get to see the confusion sort of in real time, but also now their characters very realistically are dealing with the same confusion of, well, shit, what the hell do I do now? And I thought that was, depending on the players you have, obviously, that's a really cool way to sort of start a campaign. You know, it's a really dynamic and interesting way to just grab people's attention right away and get them like really into it, you know? And I've always loved that. And I've used that same kind of variations of it plenty of times.
Yeah, I don't like that, especially it shines the biggest, I think, in Shadowrun. The awkward group first gets together time. I don't like that awkwardness of, oh, you're just thrown together and then everybody automatically has to do this. Well, I don't trust you. And it's like, stop it. Just, we're never going to get to the heist if you keep doing this. So if a GM can get everybody in as a group in a nice, smooth way, that's great. Because I am not a fan of that weird, awkward stage.
Yeah, and that's the part where like the group dynamic is key, because you got to have player buy-in to like, oh, okay, like they see what's written on the wall and buy into it and say, okay, well, let's run with this, you know, like, let's, I see what you're putting down, let's go, you know, versus being like, oh god, I don't like this, you know, I'm gonna be resistant and a stick in the mud and be a total pain in the ass, like that previous episode that we were that you guys did, like people from that episode, you know.
So earlier, Cotton mentioned jangly keys. Jangly keys are very powerful in gaming. Can you explain what jangly keys are?
Yes, the jangly keys protocol. I love this. I came up with this. I named it, I should say, during Shadowrun, because it's that element of chaos. So the jangly keys is you have your three parts to a Shadowrun: the meet, the run, and then the possible betrayal. And so if they've got a good plan, the run itself is going to be easy. The point is, you're not doing something difficult or impossible. You're doing something that doesn't want to be linked back to you. And so you're not paying for fuck-ups. But then there's going to be something else that happens, like when Cotton was going back to the whole docent thing. It's like, yeah, this is another reason why I was doing it, was because if you overemphasize something in your description, it's like, oh yeah, there's, you know, there's the dark figure in the corner, and then there's this gnome. He's got that big bulbous nose, and he's got a shock of green hair, which is weird because usually it's white. And you can only see one of his hands above the table, and he's got his other hand always below the table. And then people are like, oh, that's clearly something. And so they start ignoring what I told them to do and start looking at this other thing, these shiny keys that I'm jangling. They make a lot of noise and they glint a lot. Clearly, they're very neat. And that's what creates the challenge in the run. Now they got caught playing with the jangly keys. And meanwhile, the thing that they're supposed to do is slowly slipping away from them. One of the most notable times of that is I had a very simple run for this crew. It's like I needed them to hit a data center and get a bunch of files, any information involving this one person. And they're like, okay, well, they take the job, they walk out, and as they're walking down the street to get to their cars, this dude walks by and gives their, one of the runners was a full body cyborg basically. And this dude gives him the stink eye. And so the cyborg dude starts shit with this guy. And it turns out that this dude was part of, he was the bait for a team of bounty hunters. and they specifically had the paintball guns with the sleep agent in them to knock these guys out and basically take them into custody. So they start a massive firefight outside of the bar where their Johnson is. Cars are on fire. They've got a dude climbing up to the top of a building to chase another guy with a rifle. And just, it's complete chaos. Cops are called. Everybody's rolling in. And I happen to note, as they finally finish this combat, that the Johnson was just standing outside the bar looking at them. And he just rubs the bridge of his nose, goes back inside, and just starts dialing up the next set of runners, because clearly these ones have already shit the bed.
I run into the jangly key problem way too often. I think I either over-describe or I under-describe, and something I say gets into the players' brains, and they get, like, paranoid, and they come up with a conspiracy or something, and I'm like, what?
Because we're like, paranoid, and you often use conspiracies.
Yeah, but I'm like, no, this one's just a regular, you know.
So I keep finding myself in these donut shops. Fuck!
No, I don't think I do. And it's not just been with you guys. This has been throughout. I when I describe the setting, sometimes I guess it's all about word choice, right? You don't know what the players are going to pick up on or what they're going to take. But very often I've put a helpful NPC to the players and they automatically distrust them. And I'm like, what? Well, how am I going to help you if you don't like this guy? Now I got to make a new guy. You know? have you ever done that?
Yeah, and I've actually learned something. The more there's a certain like sine wave of description, or if you describe something too coyly, it's lethal. If we describe something too much, it's lethal. And in between, they're like, okay, this is a normal level of explanation. If you ever ramp it up, they think that's where the threat is, right? You're doing your fair bit by showing them the threat, describing the threat. So therefore, you know, you kind of have a responsibility as a GM to give your players a heads up. You don't want to be cheap and be like, oh, you didn't notice the giant guillotine in the room? Oh, well, So they tend to do a reverse association, right? Like, you have to describe danger, therefore description equals danger. And I did that purposefully to break them of that metagaming habit by over-describing a very safe house in my one-shot. You know, it's the middle of the day. It's the sheriff's house. There's the sheriff's husband. The townspeople are there. Everything screams that this is just absolutely mundane, except for how much I describe the house. And they instantly freaked out. I don't want them to do that. That's metagaming. They didn't wake up that day and it decided to metagame, right? It just it was just there. It's natural, right? To make this association. It's what's kept our species alive a long time, making associations of things. So, yeah, if you over-describe or under-describe based on your own habits, you're going to throw up flags. Oz tends to over-describe a lot, or compared to me. For him, it's just describing. So you don't know where the hits are coming from, because he's describing the hits as well as other shit, which can be really tough in a Shadowrun game. It may make you freak out completely in a tunnel system somewhere. Anyway, we're not going to worry about that. We're going to keep moving forward. And... keep moving forward. So it actually makes me want to describe things more, both to break my players of that habit and to not get it started in the first place, right? Once the habit is, I describe all the shit, and I love how Oz mentioned the five senses. I don't know about taste. You know, if I get a 4 out of 5, we're doing fine, you know? So, yeah, that would be it. I think that's a way to build your world in a small-scale tactical in that room kind of a way, hit them all the senses, describe what's in your own head, and also maybe prevent them from metagaming the shit out of you by knowing, oh, well, they just used 6 adjectives. There must be a beholder behind that door, right? So,
or hidden on the ceiling, invisible.
Yeah, that'd be a dick move.
Fuss, have you ever ran into a jangly key problem in your world building?
Oh, yeah.
Where it's distracted the players from
the main 100%. Goal. And kind of exactly like what Cotton was saying, and actually when Oz was saying that the whole thing about the five senses, I was sitting there thinking, like, man, like, there's so many times where I've, like, you know, describe like that, you know, the mystery Strider Man and then the gnome playing with the cat. You spent too much time describing that gnome playing with the cat. And that's why all of a sudden, is that the reason that they're so interested in the gnome playing with the cat? Mm-hmm. Or is it just because, you know, that's just the way they are? So everything you put down, they're just going to gobble up. And the more attention you put onto something, they will 100% pick up on. And my problem has always been, like, not that I laser focus the stuff that is important, but, like, I try and space it out, but I'm also inherently to quote Cotton, I'm inherently lazy. And so I don't want to describe too many other jangly keys because it's just too much effort, you know? But yeah, for sure. It happens all the time. I've heard I haven't heard the term jangly keys. I've heard, what is it? The catnip. I've heard catnip as the phrase where it's just, you know, something that they can't resist because they just zoom in on it regardless of what you're trying to get them to do. They will just go after it.
But that's interesting that both of you, Cotton and you, Fuzz, had mentioned when you over explain, it does send a signal to your players unconsciously or whatever, but they pick up on that and they go, oh, this must be the thing. So do you think when you do your descriptions, you try to be consistent in all of them as far as how long they are? Because like Cotton said, Oz describes everything all the time. So we never know where it's coming from.
It depends on the game. I tend to cheat a lot of times, going back to the whole letting players help me. So I'll sometimes, you know, postulate to the player, you know, where if, like, this is one of my cheat, one of my cheat moves is, you know, I'll have, like, be like, oh, well, you know, this is, you walk into this beautiful, you know, club, whatever, and I'll do a whole description of, like, there's a chandelier, there's stairs, there's waiters walking around. What are you wearing? You know? And then while they're describing how they're dressed, you know, I'm sort of thinking in the back of my head, okay, well, they're setting the formality level here. If they showed up in, like, ripped jeans and stuff like that, maybe I'm not going to have everybody be super, you know, dressed to the nines, black tie. Or maybe I will, because that's the type of feeling I want to evoke. I want them to be totally out of place. Or I want them to show up. Or maybe they showed up and they want to dress to impress everybody. So they show up in this beautiful ball gown and everyone else is just sort of wearing regular wedding clothing and is like, dude, what the fuck are you wearing? Like, why are you wearing a tiara? you know, but part of it is also I'll have them, like, describe, like, what's the type of thing that you would expect to find at this setting? You know, you're heading over to the bar, and what kind of person would your character be drawn to? You know, I'll say that, and they'll be like, oh, well, you know, if there was somebody who was, you know, clearly well-dressed, dapper guy on his own, my character would probably gravitate towards that. And I'll be like, well, it just so happens there's a guy just like that at the end of the bar in the corner seat, and he seems to be absorbed in his phone, you know, and I'll describe the guy, you know, and so I'll use them to sort of cheat of, like, kind of say, you know, what are you looking for? Basically, what are you trying to get out of this situation, or what would interest you? What kind of interaction? And gauge the temperature of the room in subtle ways by asking the players questions and have them help me cheat.
Okay, well, we're gonna wrap this up because I see we're over an hour now. Any final thoughts on world building?
The other thing I would add is good characters that are, like, good NPCs, like, you know, both the characters that your players make use their motivations and backstories to help inform your world and tie them to it. And also try to have NPCs who have other motivations beyond, like, on the world other than what relate to your own NPCs. So they can be changing it, because that's, you know, you want your world to evolve and change and be dynamic. Well, it's usually people with brains and agendas that will be doing that change. So, you know, there's something to be said for character development design, and there's probably more to be said there, but I wanted to tack it in somewhere, you know.
Anyone else?
I would agree. I don't do a lot with NPCs because I kind of prefer to let the environment speak for itself. So I do what I can. I try and make some memorable people so I can reuse them later. But I think in terms of world building, like with everything tabletop, it is a collaborative process. It should be a collaborative process. And the more, from what I've seen, and this is why I want to adopt this, the more work and the more sweat equity that your players put into building the world, then the more buy-in they have. It makes that much better of a game. They're going to be more engaged with it. So, you know, it's going to keep them coming back to the table, and not coming to the table. It's the number one killer of a tabletop game.
Yep. 100%. Yeah. And that's, I mean, over the years, that's sort of where I've kind of gravitated in terms of my thinking of, you know, get them to do some of the work, get them to buy in, and then we all tell a cool story together. And always kind of the baseline is, well, I'm not the one who's going to present this story to you. We're all going to tell a story together, regardless of what system we're playing, even if it's D&D, where, you know, the onus is almost entirely on the DM to sort of do most 99% of the work just by design of the game. I still do that, you know, and for sure, it definitely helps keep the players interested, but then also they'll surprise you because they'll give you, you know, sometimes when players get really into it, they'll start giving you the plot hooks to run with. And then you get to be entertained because now you're seeing where the story's going, that someplace where you didn't expect. And for me, that's often the most fun I have as running the GM running the game, because, you know, everything going to the plan that I sort of outlined, you know, the rough plan, I mean, yeah, that would be fine, but I could also just write a novel and that would be the same thing. Whereas the whole point is these other players are sort of going in there to screw it all up and make their own way and tell me something new and show me something new about the whole setting that I made, you know, and then let's explore this new path together. That, I think, is really important. And I think letting the players help you do that is huge in making sure that that always happens.
I firmly believe that world building should be collaborative. I think the players should take a part in it because it kind of brings in many different facets of the world from their unique perspectives. So I think it gives it a little more life and variety. So that's why I like to use the players to help collaboratively build things. I don't want to do all the work either. I'm just as lazy as BAMPS is. So I would also recommend anybody doing world building, don't go too far into it. Like, you have the entire nation's history written out, you know, when all the wars happened and historical figure. It's like half that stuff your players are never going to touch. You don't need to do all of that.
I 100% agree.
Yeah. And, you know, your world can start small, like Cotton said. The rest, what you don't know about is just, it's just blackness. So, you know, you can just build this small area of your world and you can just keep building onto it. That's good. You know, when they visit places on the map, they now have that map.
And so, and not only that, but if you're doing something like Oz's alien setup where you're sort of going to have multiple games going back to this same setting, if you write too much, you're actually putting in barriers to yourself in the future. And that's like, that was the problem with the old legacy World of Darkness. It had all this stupid meta plot of like thousands of characters and all this storyline and all this crap, and like this city has this, you know, setup, and it was just like, okay, well, what if I want to use that city but I don't care about this, you know? And you'd have to erase the board in order to start writing something new. And then the problem is, well, what if one of your players had already seen the board and really wanted to play that board? Or what if, you know, whatever the situation is, it's just more work for you to now try and clean the slate and start fresh without having expectations. And so I think that's a big thing that people also fall into, where a lot of people try and write, like, this is why I always say that, like for example, Lord of the Rings, it's a great setting. It's not a great setting for writing an RPG. It's a great setting for telling the story that those books were supposed to tell. because that's all that was really written for them. And then he wrote all this extra crap of the entire history in the Silmarillion. And it's like, okay, well, what am I supposed to write my own stories around all this stuff? You know? Mm-hmm. And that makes it harder. Yeah.
Yes. Once it's written down, it's canon. And yep. That's the thing. You have to then stick to it. So you really do want to keep a lot of unfilled areas just so you can add things in and change them on the fly. Oz, final thought?
Final thought is everybody play more tabletop games. Give me an excuse to build the world.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to world build. And we've heard several different approaches here. I do find it interesting that the three of you do your world building from the starting point of campaign story, your hook, your idea. And my world building comes before all of that. So it's different. I'd like to hear how everybody else does it. Is it based on your story, or is it you're just building a world and then you come up with, well, what happens in it? So yeah, everybody, you know, when this drops, please come to the server in the latest episode and put your thoughts on how you world build. I think that's it. You can say goodbye, Cotton.
Goodbye, Cotton.
There it is.
Bye, everybody.